So in the last period, we looked at how the Millerites were basing the interpretation of the verse in Daniel 8:14 on the each day being equal to a year, right? That's how the Millerites were interpreting it. When they read, "Unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed," they understood that it was 2,300 years. And as we've seen that, Miller was the person that most prominently in America understood this and began preaching it. But there are people around the world. I mentioned to you a few other names, right? Of people that were preaching that same message around the world. Lacunza and Joseph Wolff, and there were Miller said that he had the names and addresses of 3,000 ministers around the world which were preaching this message. So the verses we've seen how each day, each prophetic day equals a literal year. And now we come to something that even confirmed it even more. Okay? That was a confirmation that happened through the Millerite history of this principle of one day equals 1 year. Okay, one prophetic day equals one literal year. So let's read this together. This is taken from the Great Second Advent Movement by Loughborough. He says, In 1838, Dr. Josiah Litch of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, having embraced the truth set forth by William Miller, united in the work of giving greater publicity to the message. He prepared articles for the public print on the subject of the seven trumpets of Revelation. He took the unqualified position that the sixth trumpet would cease to sound and the Ottoman power fall on the 11th day of August, 1840, and that would demonstrate to the world that a day in symbolic prophecy represents a year of little time. Let's see what the Spirit of Prophecy says about it. Great Controversy 334, it is written, "In the year 1840, another remarkable fulfillment of prophecy excited widespread interest." I'll pause here and I'll just make a note on this. Ellen White is saying that in the year 1840, a remarkable fulfillment of prophecy took place. Please don't forget that. Because we will see how people are shooting all over the place trying to interpret the trumpets different than the Millerites interpreted, and then when Ellen White says that and calls it a remarkable fulfillment of prophecy. This for me is so amazing, so difficult to understand how people could do that. They claim to believe the Spirit of Prophecy, yet they will make a different interpretation. And not just say that, oh, she was right and there's another interpretation also, but actually think that she was wrong and the true interpretation is something else. That's what surprises me, okay? So let's continue reading. After she says that another remarkable fulfillment of prophecy excited widespread interest, she continues, "2 years before, Josiah Litch, one of the leading ministers preaching the Second Advent, published an exposition of Revelation 9. Predicting the fall of the Ottoman Empire. According to his calculations, this power was to be overthrown in AD 1840, sometime in the month of August. And only a few days previous to its accomplishment, he wrote, allowing the first period, 150 years, to have been exactly fulfilled before Diakosis ascended the throne by permission of the Turks, And that the 391 years, 15 days commenced at the close of the first period, it will end on the 11th of August, 1840, when the Ottoman power in Constantinople may be expected to be broken. And this, I believe, will be found to be the case. Who wrote that? Who wrote this part here saying about the prediction? Josiah Litch, right? And Ellen White is quoting Josiah Litch. But before she quotes him, she calls it a remarkable fulfillment of prophecy. So, what do you think? I ask you this because people can read this and say, that wasn't a fulfillment of prophecy. Basically, that's what they're saying. Several different people, and even prominent authors. It is amazing. So, I choose to follow what is written, right? The revelation, what inspiration has said, that is the right one. Now, remember, Josiah Litch wrote on an exposition of Revelation 9. There were other authors in the Advent movement which also wrote about that. You have Uriah Smith talking about Revelation 8 and 9. You have James White. He has a book called We'll quote from this book. I forgot the name right now, but in a few slides it will come. And we'll see which one it is. Let's continue here. On what did Josiah Litch base the understanding he had about the 391 years and 15 days? On which verse of the Bible? It was based on Revelation 9:15. And this to many will be shocking, because if you read the verse, it just says, "And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year for to slay the third part of men." They read this and they think, oh, it's something at the end of times. It will be just a terrible disaster. And, there will be Satan's angels or even God's angels, who knows, four angels which will come and destroy people. So you have all sorts of wild explanations of this. But yet, the Millerites understood it, and based on this verse, they made a prediction. The Ottoman power will be broken on the 11th of August of 1840. And do you know what happened? On that very same day, their power was broken. 2 years before that event, Josiah Litch said that in the month of August, this would happen. And about 2 weeks before, he published in the newspaper saying, on the 11th of August, this will happen. And it happened just like predicted. So, for me, before I understood what they were saying, I thought, this verse must be talking about some terrible event. This is just the natural thing for people that don't go deep in the study of Revelation to come up with, right? We just read at face value. Instead of interpreting the symbol, we take it at face value. You know, there are other examples of people taking it at face value without interpretation. When it talks about the beast coming up out of the sea, have you heard that? Revelation 13? There was somebody that said, I'm afraid of going to the beach anymore. Because, the beast comes out of the sea. So what was that person understanding? That it was a literal beast living in the sea, whatever sea it is, and it would come out of the sea. Can you imagine? So when we say that these four angels are prepared, to slay the third part of life on earth, and they're literal angels, and this is the third part of the whole earth, and then if we assume that position, we're being just like this person that was afraid of going to the sea. Right? We're interpreting at face value instead of using the symbol and trying to understand what the Bible says. Because remember, large portions of the book of Daniel, you know, the non-narrative portions, and basically the whole of Revelation is symbolic. There are symbols involved, you know. Only a few portions of Revelation are narrative. So, let's continue here. Let's try to understand then what the Millerites understood about the seven trumpets, okay? Let's try to trace their history. And listen, we need to go back to what the Spirit of Prophecy says. So I'll show you a few things and then we'll try to understand. As you can see here, the Roman Empire, which is the red and the orange colors, was divided in half for most of its life. But Constantine had three sons, and he divided the empire in three parts to the three sons. That's why we hear of a third part of men. The trumpets were marking the destruction of the Roman Empire, and they were the transition between the Roman Empire and what was to come next. Okay? So the first four trumpets are judgments of God upon the Western Empire. That means the red one, the one that is located in most of Europe. The fifth and the sixth trumpets are judgments of God upon the Eastern Empire, or the Byzantine Empire. Although the sixth trumpet especially involves more than just that Eastern Empire, right? It also talks about the fall of the Ottoman power. The seventh trumpet is not fulfilled yet. It has begun to be sounded. As far as I understand, it began in 1844. And, you know, there is even a hymn that says, while the seventh trumpet is sounding. While the seventh trumpet is sounding, right? So, but this is, the seventh trumpet is something I need to understand more. So I'm not claiming to know about the seventh trumpet, nor are we going to focus on it. But the first six trumpets, there is explanation for it, clear explanation, and we'll look at it, okay? So, taking a look at this map, this was in the year, I think, 117 AD. You can see on the, in this part here, Hispania, like Spain. Those are Roman provinces. Gallia, you see? Britannia in Great Britain. So the names, many of them, remain today of what they were in the Roman period. Right? The yellow dots, or squares, are the legions that were stationed at certain places. Each legion has a name, so as you can see here, on this side here. In Judea, there was a legion stationed there. And in many places, the Romans were using a system of defense at the borders. Now, on which side of this line here was the Roman Empire? Left or right? On the left side, right? So, all over here. Even down to Africa, the north part of Africa. So, what was on the right side where, you know, part of, a great part of Germany, you know, Poland, you know, Ukraine. There were the Germanic tribes, right? So the Germanic tribes, the Suebi, Burgundians, you know, the Goths, the Saxons, the Angles, do you see them here? Sarmatians, you know, the Vandals, all these guys, the Heruli. They were on this unconquered part of Europe, at least by the Roman Empire. And do you see what marks the separation here? Do you see what river is this? This is the Rhine, yes. How about on this side? Do you know what river this is? Oh, sorry. Danube, right? What? So the Danube and the Rhine were the natural limits of the Roman Empire. So in between the Rhine and the Danube, there was an open way. And the Germanic tribes would frequently invade the Roman Empire through that open way. So one of the emperors built a long wall, as you can see here. It's a gigantic wall, which didn't work, by the way. China, the wall in China, the wall that was in the northern portion of England, those walls have proved that long fortified or extensively fortified tracts of land cannot protect, because it's impossible to be at all of it at the same time. And if you're not guarding all, you just need one breach and they're, you know, almost useless. So this didn't work. The barbarians, or what the Romans called the barbarians, the Germanic tribes kept pouring in into the empire. But even so, the Rhine and the Danube were natural barriers. Okay, so as long as the barbarians or Germanic tribes were still on the outside of the Roman Empire, the empire was still surviving. But the first tribe to actually make it in, come in, and invade the empire was the Visigoths. The tribe of the Visigoths, or the Goths, right? That was the first tribe to come in. And the way they came in was very interesting, because there was one point of time that they were all in the margin of the Danube, I think, and they were pleading and begging the emperor, please let us come in. We're going to be destroyed. I think the Huns were coming and were pushing them, and the Huns were stronger than them. So they were begging to come into the empire to be protected from the Huns, right? And the emperor made a deal with them and said, give me your weapons and you will come in. But the people in the boats that were supposed to cross them over the river accepted money instead of the weapons. So the Goths, when they were transferred in, 1.5 million were a fully armed people inside the empire. Now, imagine 1.5 million of those, of the Visigoths. Compare that to a legion. A legion has about 6,000 men with the auxiliaries. About 6,000 men. So even if the Roman power had 10 legions stationed there, what would that be compared to 1.5 million of the Goths, right? Even though women and children were there. But yet, it was too many people. So they were let loose inside the empire, and the empire couldn't do anything about it. They defeated the Romans, and they went down here to Achaia, you know, Athens, and they were sacking everything. They were destroying everything on the way. And we will see a little more of this, because they turned their eyes to Rome and came to Rome and sacked Rome and burnt it. The first people, the first of the peoples to come and actually destroy Rome was the Visigoths. Okay, we'll see that a little more. So let's just see how the spirit of prophecy explains the fifth and the sixth trumpet. I mean, we saw how the spirit of prophecy explains the fifth and the sixth trumpet, as we read there when she was talking about Revelation 9, the exposition that Josiah Litch made. The fifth and the sixth trumpets, Ellen White clearly agrees with what the Millerites were saying. Josiah Litch was a Millerite. So she basically endorses what they were saying about this. And she is using this in great controversy. She's not using everything, but she's using that portion because it fits at the time period that she's talking about, and that's the Millerite movement. She uses that to prove that Miller's interpretation was correct. Okay? So this is how the Millerites and the early SDA interpreted the trumpets. So the first trumpet, they interpreted to be the Goths under Alaric, and they were falling upon the Western Roman Empire. If you see the W here, that means it's upon the Western one. If you see the E as Eastern one, right? Okay, so let's read this. You can read the verses on your own of the trumpets. So just open Revelation 8 and 9, you know, and you can follow along. So the first trumpet refers to the Goths under Alaric, right? It says, "Hail and fire mingled with blood were cast upon the earth. The terrible effects of this Gothic invasion are represented as hail from the fact of the northern origin of the invaders." They came all the way from the north. They must have been like, you know, blue-eyed and blonde and very white. And so they come as from the north. "Fire from the destruction by flame of both city and country, and blood from the terrible slaughter of the citizens of the empire by the bold and intrepid warriors." Okay, so just remember, the way the Goths came into Rome, you know, Rome was a fortified city. How could they come in? How could they enter Rome? They were encamped about Rome, around Rome, but they just couldn't come in. Do you know what happened though? At midnight, some of the slaves, the slaves of the Romans, which might as well be just, you know, Germanic in origin, they opened the gates of the city, one of the gates. They betrayed the Romans. And from inside of the city, they opened the gate. And the Goths were able to come in, rush in. And the citizens of Rome at midnight were awakened by the Gothic trumpets. Can you believe that? You're sleeping thinking that you're safe. And then all through the streets, bum, 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 the sound of the trumpets of war. Not from you, but from your enemies. Can you believe that? That was the first scourge upon Rome. Okay? So remember, the trumpets, the first four trumpets, are punishments or the scourge of God upon the Western Empire. And basically, the Goths burnt the city of Rome, okay? During 4 years, the Goths ravaged and reigned over it without control. And in the pillage and fire of Rome, the streets of the city were filled with dead bodies. The flames consumed many public and private buildings, and the ruins of a palace remained, after a century and a half, a stately monument of the Gothic conflagration. Conflagration means burning, right? So how did the pioneers interpret the first trumpet? Uriah Smith, James White, A.T. Jones, Josiah Litch, the Millerites interpreted to be the Goths under Alaric. Okay? How about the second trumpet? Let's try to go over a little faster here. The Vandals under Genseric. So often in the trumpets, you will hear of a third part of. Have you seen that? A third part of? Okay, let's look here and see what it means. Okay? The Roman Empire after Constantine was divided into three parts. And hence the frequent remark, a third part of men, etc., in allusion to the third part of the empire, which was under the scourge. Okay? Which part of the empire is being punished? Well, if it is this, then it says a third part of whatever, you know, of men, of the trees, of something else. This division of the Roman kingdom was made at the death of Constantine between his three sons, Constantius, Constantine II, and Constance. Those are the names of his three sons. Very creative, right? Constantius possessed the east and fixed his residence at Constantinople, the metropolis of the empire. Constantine II held Britain, Gaul, and Spain. Constance held Illyricum, Africa, and Italy. Okay, so let's look at the second trumpet. The Vandals, right? Under Genseric. The history illustrative of the sound of the second trumpet evidently relates to the invasion and conquest of Africa, and afterward of Italy by the terrible Genseric. His conquests were for the most part naval. Now, if you look at the second trumpet, how does it read? It said that a great mountain, burning like fire, was thrown into the sea, right? Imagine, the other conquest wasn't in the sea. Hail was cast upon the earth. The Gothic invasion was only upon the earth, the dry part of the empire. Now this, the second trumpet, is cast upon the sea. So coming back to the text, his conquests were for the most part naval. Naval means in the sea. Right? And his triumphs were, as it were, a great mountain burning with fire cast into the sea. What figure would better or even so well illustrate the collision of navies and the general havoc of war on the maritime coasts? If the sounding of the first four trumpets relates to four remarkable events which contributed to the downfall of the Roman Empire, and the first trumpet refers to the ravages of the Goths under Alaric, in this we naturally look for the next succeeding act of invasion which shook the Roman power and conducted to its fall, and conduced to its fall. The next great invasion was that of the terrible Genseric at the head of the Vandals. His career occurred during the years AD 428 to 468. This great Vandal chief had his headquarters in Africa, but as Gibbon states, the discovery and conquest of the black nations in Africa that might dwell beneath the torrid zone could not tempt the rational ambition of Genseric, but he cast his eyes towards the sea. He resolved to create a naval power, and his bold resolution was executed with steady and active perseverance. So he made a naval power, and guess where he put his base? Let's go back to the map. Where were the Vandals in this map? Right here, right? Vandali. Vandals. Remember, these are Roman names. This is how the Romans called them. Right? So, how did they end up in Africa? And of all places, in Carthage. How did they end up there? Well, they came down through this route, and they came all the way down here. And one of the Roman officers facilitated their crossing over into Africa. He was planning to rid Europe of their attacks. So he helped them to cross over onto Africa. And from here, they conquered everything all the way to Carthage. Carthage was a very immoral city. Every street had its own general, basically, because so many retired generals from the Roman armies went to live at Carthage. There was very wicked activities there. So when the Vandals came in and conquered Carthage, it was just like the Puritans, you know, coming into a... it was like the armies of the Puritans coming into Carthage. They were pure compared to all the wicked inhabitants of Carthage, you know. And they didn't take part in their immorality. They just banished the places of harlots. They banished things. They closed down. And they took control of the city, you know. So it was like the scourge of God coming onto it. Okay. So from Carthage, making his base there, Genseric attacked many of the other places in the empire. So from Greece to Spain to Italy, he was attacking everywhere. Okay, so let's go back to where we were. From the port of Carthage, he repeatedly made piratical sallies and preyed on the Roman commerce and waged war with that empire. To cope with the sea monarch, the Roman emperor, Majorian, made extensive naval preparations. 300 long galleys, and remember, these are big warships. 300 long galleys with an adequate proportion of transports and smaller vessels were collected in the secure and capacious harbor of Cartagena in Spain. But Genseric was saved from impending and inevitable ruin by the treachery of some powerful subjects, envious or apprehensive of their master's success. Guided by their secret intelligence, he surprised the unguarded fleet in the Bay of Cartagena. Many of the ships were sunk, taken or burned, and the preparations of 3 years were destroyed in a single day. For 3 years, the empire was preparing to attack the Vandals, making long and large ships, and in one day, Genseric destroyed them all. Isn't that amazing? Italy continued to be long afflicted by the incessant depredations of the Vandal pirates. In the spring of each year, they equipped a formidable navy in the port of Carthage, and Genseric himself, though at a very advanced age, still commanded in person the most important expeditions. Now, how would he command this, and how would he know where to attack? This, for me, is something amazing. Look at this. When he was... Let me go back here. His designs were concealed with impenetrable secrecy till the moment that he hoisted sail. When he was asked by his pilot what course he should steer, look at his answer. When the pilot said, well, where are we going? He would say, leave the determination to the winds, replied the barbarian with pious arrogance. They will transport us to the guilty coasts whose inhabitants have provoked the divine justice. Can you believe that? Can you believe that? Do you understand then why it was the scourge of God upon the Western Empire? It seems like he himself knew it. He just said, leave it. This is the scourge of God. They provoke the anger, the indignation, or the justice of God. So we will go to the right place. This is amazing. At last, a desperate attempt to dispossess the sovereignty of the sea was made in the year 468 by the emperors, by the emperor of the East. Hang on, let me read this again because I didn't read well. A last and desperate attempt to dispossess Genseric from the sovereignty of the sea was made in the year 468 by the emperor of the East. Let's read how it was. The whole expense of the African campaign amounted to the sum of 130 pounds of gold, about 5,200,000 pounds sterling. The fleet that sailed from Constantinople to Carthage consisted of 1,113 ships, and the number of soldiers and mariners exceeded 100,000 men. So, what was the last attempt that they made to destroy Genseric? The first one was frustrated, right? The first one was in the port of Spain, and Genseric went there and destroyed the 300 ships. Now, how many ships are on the second attempt? 1,113 ships. Can you imagine? More than 1,000 warships. And over 100,000 soldiers and mariners. The army of Heraclius and the fleet of Marcellinus either joined or seconded the imperial lieutenant. The wind became favorable to the designs of Genseric. He manned his largest ships of war with the bravest of the Moors and Vandals, and they towed after them many large barks filled with combustible materials. So how did Genseric then prepare to war? He knew that he couldn't win against 1,100 ships. So the winds became favorable, and actually there was a mist that settled, and they couldn't see well what was in front. So he filled many of his ships with combustible materials. And he put his men there, and they quietly went towards the larger fleet of the Romans. In the obscurity of the night, these destructive vessels were impelled against the unguarded and unsuspecting fleet of the Romans, who were awakened by a sense of their instant danger. So, let me read this again. So remember, Genseric filled his ships with combustible materials, maybe wood, maybe, you know, burning liquid. And in the obscurity of the night, these destructive vessels were impelled against the unguarded and unsuspecting fleet of the Romans, who were awakened by a sense of their instant danger. Their close and crowded order assisted the progress of the fire, which was communicated with rapid and irresistible violence. And the noise of the wind, the crackling of the flames, the dissonant cries of the soldiers and mariners, who could neither command nor obey, increased the horror of the nocturnal tumult. Whilst they labored to extricate themselves from the fireships and to save at least a part of the navy, the galleys of Genseric assaulted them with temperate and disciplined valor, and many of the Romans who escaped the fury of the flames were destroyed or taken by the victorious Vandals. How did that happen then? All the big fleet of the Romans was just destroyed by the smaller fleet of the Vandals, because the Vandals pushed forward ships burning. And they lit fire on the other ships of the Romans. And the reason the Romans couldn't flee away is because they were so crowded together that the ships couldn't maneuver. So they just burned up. And again, Genseric became the tyrant of the sea. Okay? We'll finish with the second trumpet. And in the next period, we'll pick up from there.